Well, good morning, everybody. Should have cleared my throat before the show started. Come on, music. There we go. Sorry about that. Hey, I'm Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thank you for listening. 10:30 in the morning, December 20th, 2016. Now with a clear throat. And we have a very interesting show for you. We've got Andrew Pillow, who's a fifth grade social studies teacher. I love the fact that he's a fifth grade teacher and a social studies teacher. I was a social studies teacher. He teaches at KIPP Indianapolis College Prep. Sounds good. And also, thanks to my friend Anya over at Teach Plus, who helped me set up the show, he is a Teach Plus Teaching Policy Fellowship alum. Wow, that's a long title. So Andrew's going to talk about the resegregation of schools, which is, in fact, a de facto fact. Can you be a de facto fact? But it's true, and it's strange. And, we'll talk with him. It's going to be a good show. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org, and we're going to tweet it out again over at EduTalkRadio. Please follow us if you're involved in education at EduTalkRadio on Twitter. You can follow Andrew at Andrew Pillow, P-I-L-L-O-W, just like the thing you sleep on. All right, and it's an interesting topic. Let me bring Andrew on right now. Andrew, how you doing? It's Larry.
How are you doing?
I'm good, my friend. Everything good? What's the weather like in Indianapolis today, Andrew?
You don't even want to know. I
do want to know.
Let me
make you feel better. Let me make you feel better. I live in Maine. And when I got up this morning, it was -9. So how is it in Indianapolis?
Well, it's single digits, but at least you guys in Maine are used to that type of weather. I mean, we're not prepared for it to be single digits this early. So,
I know. It's been cold. It's been cold. And by the way, are you not on a speakerphone, are you? I just want to make sure
I'm
can
not.
Hear you. Okay, talk directly into your phone so everyone can hear you. You teach at the KIPP Indianapolis College Prep. Sounds really good. And as I said before, you're a social studies teacher, but a fifth grade one, which I love. Okay, that's great. I'm an old social studies teacher. Emphasis on the old. Tell us about KIPP, where you teach.
Yeah, so KIPP Indianapolis is a charter school. It's in the Lower East Side of Indianapolis. And we have two schools in the same building right now. So we have an elementary school and we have a middle school. They're technically two separate schools, but we kind of operate as one. And
nice.
I teach
That's
social
good.
Studies and technology and current events there. So it's a pretty interesting time.
And you teach social studies and technology. If they depended on me for that, we'd still be using duct tape to glue rocks together. So I congratulate you on that. Okay, it's good stuff. Hey, you know, this is a really interesting topic, resegregation of schools. And I never did a show on this topic before, but as I said before, I don't know if you can call something a de facto fact, but in fact it is a de facto fact, is it not?
Well, it definitely is. I think a lot of people get caught up on the fact that we don't have segregated schools de jure and take that to mean that we don't have them de facto.
By law.
We do.
Yeah, by law. Segregated schools du jour. I like that. Oh, God. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I think that one of the things that people don't realize is that schools are, in fact, still segregated. Now, whether you want to argue the definition of segregation or not, it really is still the same end result. We have segregated schools. Most minorities attend a school that is partially segregated, if not, you know, intensely segregated. And it's actually getting worse, which is kind of what the opposite of what you would expect given, you know, history and court decisions.
Yeah, well, considering everything these days, I wouldn't necessarily be surprised that it's getting worse. And it is actually, let me, I don't know if you know the answer to that, but you brought up something that struck me. Does segregation mean that it's legal to segregate, or segregation just the fact that there's, I'll call, say, zero diversity or getting close to zero? That's interesting. I don't know the definition.
It's one of those things that it depends on who you ask. I mean, it's one of those political definitions that people like to debate what it means, and whatever side you talk to will tell you a different definition. I can tell you that when I use a definition and when people in Ed Reform use a definition, they typically talk about the end result, not necessarily the, you know, law, because
yeah, the policy.
There are
yeah.
ways around, you know, a policy. For example, you may not have a school using race as a factor to limit diversity explicitly, but if the district that the school is pulling from is an all-white district, and there have been, and as we know, there have also been racial, you know, issues with where people are, can and are allowed to live, then technically
yeah,
the end result is the same.
To say the least, my friend. Okay, it's really something. And why do you think this is happening? Do you think it's intentional, or do you think it's just a matter, if I may, of economics?
You know what? I don't necessarily think that everything bad that happens race-wise is like some type of actual malice issue. I do think that there are factors that contribute, and I also think that there's kind of this mythos that we ever actually desegregated schools, which really isn't the case. If you ask people, you know, about school segregation, they'll say, well, a long time ago, we had separate schools for black and whites, then we had Ruby Bridges
right.
and, you know, Little Rock, Arkansas, and now schools are desegregated. But really, that isn't actually the case. Essentially, what you had is that Supreme Court decisions only mandated that schools couldn't use race as a factor to limit diversity, but it didn't really say that you couldn't use other things as factors to limit diversity. And that's what a lot of areas have done. So in the South, where schools were mostly limited by mandate, you know, schools desegregated rather quickly. And those schools are actually the least segregated now, because those schools are the ones that were intentionally segregated by race
right.
to limit diversity. But in places like the Northeast, let's say New York, New Jersey, for example, schools that were pulling from districts that were all white or have become all white over time are still that way, and schools that were pulling from districts that were all black or have become all black or all Hispanic over time are still that way. So ironically, what you have is a situation where schools in the areas that we deem quote-unquote least racist are the ones that are most segregated.
And, you know, I have to ask you a question. I don't know whether you watch. I think it was called the Air Force Reserve Bowl, okay, last Saturday. I don't know if you're a football fan or not, but it was one of the – one of the schools from North Carolina and then Grambling, okay, were playing.
Uh-huh.
All right. It was a good game, as a matter of fact. And they were both historically black universities. All right. And by the way, the best halftime show in the world is the Grambling halftime show.
Oh, Grambling band.
Oh, it's unbelievable. But my question is, and by the way, the punter I noticed on the North Carolina team was a white kid, okay? But everybody else on the team was black, and obviously the whole Grambling team was African American too. But I'm curious about something. This is a weird question. Is it bad to be segregated? Because the schools, the historically black schools, okay, are pretty much segregated. There's a distinct lack of diversity, and that's good. But when we look at it at K-12, it's an interesting juxtaposition. What's your thought on that? And by the way, it was a great game.
Oh, yeah, I didn't get a chance to watch that game.
It was
good. I'm a fan of black college football. It is an interesting debate. So when I talk about this, I am mainly talking about black students being able to attend school with white students, because the resources tend to follow white students around. When you really go back and look at the decision that was made, you know, it was basically saying that separate schools are inherently unequal. Now, most black colleges predate that decision, and they are black
because they
didn't necessarily have a choice about where they could go to school. Now people do, but because of, you know, vestiges of the past and, you know, choices that people make, they kind of still want to go to those schools, and I understand that. But But I think if you do the research, you'll actually find that quite a few of those black colleges are, in fact, more diverse than their state counterparts. I just know, for example, from my own experience going to the University of Kentucky, the University of Kentucky has a lower black population than Kentucky State, which is our resident HBCU, has of white population. There's a higher percentage of white students at Kentucky State than there is black students at the University of Kentucky. And that might change depending on which HBCU you look at. But I think that when we're talking about it from a K-12 standpoint, now we're talking about students, you know, being limited from life of choice because they go to a school that doesn't have the resources that, you know, the suburban school has.
What got you interested, besides the fact, I think you're, are you African-American? I believe you are.
I am.
Yeah, okay, cool. Okay, so what got you interested in this? What was the tipping point that got you interested? I mean, I would bet you teach at a terrific school. Is it mostly African-American kids, or is it diverse, or what is it? And so what got you interested in it? I think it's great.
My school is mostly African-American. We have a few Hispanics and a few white students as well. They're mostly all in one grade, but we do have students from other races. I will say this, what got me interested in it, though, isn't necessarily my experience in high school so much as it is the juxtaposition between my experience, juxtaposition of my experience to the experience my students have. So I went to school in Jefferson County Public Schools. Louisville has extremely diverse schools, and it's that way on purpose. It's often used as one of the examples, along with Charlotte before whatever court case they had that limited their ability to desegregate schools. It's used as the example of a place where desegregation has been done right. So all my life I went to, you know, diverse schools, and I benefited greatly from that, as I found out when I went to college. And then I go to Teach for America, end up at my school here, which is, like you said, I mean, we're an A-rank school, right? We're a good school. And
I would figure
a class where all the students are black. And that isn't necessarily a bad thing in and of itself, right? Like, you don't have to have a black kid next to a white kid for the black kid to learn. But what you're typically dealing with, though, is in a situation where schools are separate, they are almost inherently unequal. So you have a lot of times, because funding tends to follow affluent, you know, affluence around, then the schools that have mostly minorities are now also unable to do a lot of the things that other schools are able to do. Like, maybe the responses to intervention aren't as good, or class size is a common problem. So there are typically things that make less diverse schools less successful, particularly for minority children.
Okay, so let me give you an example from my experience. I grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. All right, and I went to Overbrook High School, which, by the way, I'm proud to say is the same high school where actor Will Smith and Will Chamberlain went, and Walt Hazard and all that. It was about 80% black kids. Okay, it was great. I have great memories of that. Okay, Philadelphia, though, has become more and more an African-American city. Okay, just more and more. Okay, and how do you create a diverse atmosphere? Okay, in a city like Philly, which is heavily African-American. I mean, the kids that go to school are African-American. There's not enough white kids to go around.
You know, it's interesting. So you can't create diversity where none exists, right? And that's just that's simply a thing that we're just going to have to, you know, understand. However, when we're talking about not being able to create diverse schools, we're typically talking about areas where there are mostly white students, right? So there are rural areas where there simply aren't any black people around, right? We get that. But even when you're talking about cities, there are typically white people around. So you might be looking at the city limits where now, because of white flight or what have you, whatever you want to call it, now the city limits are mostly black. Yeah, right? But if you look at the metropolitan area, usually that white population shoots up. And what you have in places where, say, the city has merged with the county, like in Louisville, right, it's afforded you the opportunity to make schools where you can now include some of those suburbs that wouldn't have been included in your school district if you haven't actually hadn't have merged previously with your county. So in places where white folks have moved past the taxable boundary of the city, then now you're looking at those schools where they're not diverse. But they're still there. Most major cities have a large white base, even if they don't live within the city. I mean, I'm thinking about Chicago. I'm thinking about Naperville of Chicago, Carmel in Indianapolis. I guess, you know, the Silicon Valley area to San Francisco. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But suburbs of those cities.
And your example, I used to live in Chicago, so I know your example as well about that. But how do you – while I agree with you that there's – let me just say it this way – diversity across the border, if I may, okay?
Uh-huh.
And this is a problem. This is a challenge. People moved across the border, quote – for better schools. And I'm not saying that schools aren't good if there's black kids or Latino kids there. I'm saying that's the mindset. They moved. Okay. Are you suggesting that more and more cities, like Louisville, which I didn't even know that they did that, encompass the schools of the surrounding more white communities, more diverse, to create diversity? It's a tough thing. I mean, wow.
Yeah, I think it's difficult. In Louisville, it was easy because Jefferson County Public Schools was already the district. I'm not necessarily
Kentucky has countywide schools. I forgot about that. Yeah, yep. But most, like Pennsylvania, we'll use Pennsylvania as the other example, and maybe Indiana too. That's not the case. You're right. I forgot about that.
Yeah, I mean, where I live is a pizza pie of different townships and school districts and things like that. But I think that to your point, though, cities have to be intentional about it. It doesn't necessarily require busing kids clear across town. It doesn't necessarily require merging school districts. But if you can be intentional about it, as some places have done, for example, because the Supreme Court has now ruled that you can't use race as a factor to protect diversity, you have to find things that are proxies for diversity, and it's an imperfect formula, right? So I know where I'm from, they use zip codes. Every school, like certain schools, have certain zip codes they pull from, and those zip codes happen to be places where a lot of black people live. For example, I know that my friends, I went to a magnet school, but my friends, you know, who lived in a housing project, went to Ballard High School, which is way on the east side of Louisville. Like, it's not really that close. But they pulled from that district because they knew that they would be getting black kids from that zip code. So even though the Supreme Court has ruled essentially in the last, you know, two or three decades that you can't use race as a factor to protect diversity, there are still ways to do it. And certain areas are doing it well. You just have to find those areas and emulate what they're doing. Whatever I say won't work for every place, right? Because there's different policies, like different types of counties, different townships. But there are places pretty much in every state where they have done it effectively, and people have to emulate what those states are doing, and you need the political will to do it. I think part of the problem is that what you said is true. A lot of white families have moved because as more black people move, the housing prices and things like that went down, and there was a stigma of sending your kids to a school of minorities, when in fact that stigma is almost completely artificially created, because there's a study that came out from Berkeley that just said segregated schools had no negative impact on white kids by any metric.
I believe that.
Part of it is fighting that stigma.
I believe that. But let me ask you something. Is there also in this, okay, we talked about, quote, white flight, but black people, as they have certainly moved into the middle and upper classes, they've moved to better school districts too. Okay? Correct. Has that affected I want to ask this the right way. Is diversity better in the inner suburbs than it's ever been? Let's look at a positive here. what used to be an all-white school, where I used to teach, as a matter of fact, it's a good example. I used to teach in Cheltenham, just north of Philadelphia, the two towns. Philadelphia and Cheltenham bordered each other, okay? And
yeah,
it was mostly...
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, and it was mostly white kids. But as black people became, you know, moved up in the economics, a lot more African-American kids and Latino kids came into the district. And the district demos changed, and it made for a far more diverse district. Okay? What's your thoughts on that, Andrew? You're a thinker.
I think that what you said is absolutely true. So you had whites move, and then the blacks and Hispanics followed the whites. So when the white flight takes place, typically we follow them because we want what, you know, the resources.
What everybody else wants. Hello.
That they have.
Yeah.
So if you look at the suburbs of Indianapolis, for example, the townships, right, IPS, Indianapolis Public Schools is Center Township. Then the outer townships are the suburbs. And those suburbs are those township schools are quite diverse. Actually, a lot of those schools are still Title I, you know, funded schools. They're diverse schools. They're what you would expect a inner city public school to look like in, like, the 80s, right? But, in fact, the people – who move to those cities or move to those township schools have left behind the students in the center township, the innermost part of the city. And that creates problems on two levels. So, yes, you have the pro of those schools becoming more diverse, but you still have a very large population of students who are left in schools that now not only are even less diverse than they were, but are disproportionately left with students who – need more resources, and you also have an infrastructure that is set up for way more students that are now currently enrolled. You have buildings that have are built for 2,000 kids in like the 70s, but you might have 400 students in there. So now you're using headcount money for students, and it's not going as far because you're paying $1 million a year to keep your building operational.
Right,
using money that you should be using to limit your class size, but you can't use it on that because your property tax money isn't as high, and the headcount money doesn't stretch as far because your building is built for 2,000 or 3,000 kids, and you have 200 or 300 in there, and that's a big problem as well.
It really is.
Pro,
in fact, at Overbrook, I heard this where I went to high school, Overbrook, okay? I heard it was a five-story building built around 1900, I guess. Okay, it's still in use, but I heard that like either the fourth and the fifth floor are no longer used, that it's now down to just floors 1, 2, and 3, or whatever it is. But I know that the fifth floor is not used anymore. Okay,
yeah,
which
exactly
it's a real conundrum. You know, is there an answer? Well, I mean, is there really? I mean, do we take kids from that second ring of suburbs now and bust them back and forth, or what do we do?
I think that what you really have to do is that it has to be a policy decision that is made by lawmakers. I don't necessarily think that you necessarily need to bust kids back and forth. I think what in Indianapolis what needs to happen is that they need to close some schools. We have too many schools in the interior, and they're not filled to capacity. And they're disproportionately segregated. And I think naturally what you'll see is that a lot of those kids in the interior will start going to some of those exterior schools. We're only talking about 5 and 6 miles difference in some cases.
Yep.
Right? So a lot of these schools that are still fairly segregated shouldn't even be open anymore. I mean, why do we have a building that was operating for 2,000
kids? Yeah, but even if you closed it,
200.
The other school, if they go to high school A, there's high school A and B, they're 4 miles apart, they're both in the city, okay, any given city. You close A and put all the kids into B, you still got a segregated school.
But if you close A and B, those kids can go to the exterior schools. Or if you close A and B, or if you just close one or the other and one of them is a little bit more diverse, I'm just trying to think about situations that I can see here where we have too many schools and it's better to have one or two not diverse schools that you can You know what I'm saying? Like, we can we can give funding to those schools, give them the resources they need, right? Because part of the problem with less diverse schools is funding. So it's not just that they're not going to school white kids. It's the fact that these schools are underfunded.
Underfunded,
and we don't have a way to combat
that
because we're paying too much money for infrastructure. So
Let me throw this one at you. Okay? The first thing people, and Andrew, you know this, the first thing people ask when they buy a house, the first thing is, how are the schools? That's the first thing they ask. Okay?
Yeah.
Because the schools, and that you can ask any realtor in the country. Okay? That's a fact. All right? So just everybody think yourself. All right. Now you've got a city. Let's just use Indianapolis. Why not? You're there. Okay? If they would put more money into the schools, they'd have more people coming into the city, or young people, okay, and use Philadelphia as an example of this too, staying. What's happening in Philly, younger folks, okay, are starting their families in Philly, and the minute, and they're paying $600,000 for a house that would have cost $5,000 when I was a kid. I'm not kidding, all right? So, but the houses are cool. But the minute their kids become school age, off they go to the suburbs or Jersey, okay, in Philly, okay? But if the schools, it's the most ridiculous conundrum in the world. The schools are under-resourced. If they fully resourced the schools, everybody would stay, and you'd have a greater tax base.
Yeah,
you need to put more money
that,
into the schools. It's now that I'm thinking about it, it's the stupidest damn thing in the world. Okay, they put less money into the schools than wonder why everybody's heading off to the suburbs.
And I think one of the issues is that when they put less money into the schools, as little money as it looks like it is, it's actually less, right? Because when you're talking about taking care of the infrastructure, you're not talking about using that per pupil money for education. You're talking about using it for other things like school safety and busing and things like that. So even though it's not that much money, it's even actually less than what it looks like. And I think that we're having that problem in Indianapolis too. We're seeing a lot of revitalization of the area. And I'm wondering what IPS is going to look like when these young families that are in the cool, hip, you know, Mass Ave, that's our, you know, cool district of downtown part, are going to look like when it becomes school age. Because I got to be honest, I don't know if I would
put
my kids
in school. I can tell you what it's
going to
look like. They're going to sell it to another family, okay, who's just getting started, okay, and move out to the suburbs. It's going to be that simple.
I do think
school
choice could combat this.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. What are you going to do with all this? This is a good thought. You've got some good stuff here. What are you going to do with all this? You going to write a book? Write a book.
You know what? I think that one of the things that we're working on now is policies here locally in Indianapolis. I do have a blog where I publish these thoughts. Every now and then people actually even read it.
What is the blog? What is it?
Indy.education.
Indy.education. www.indy, like Indianapolis, indy.education. Okay.
Correct.
People need to go over there. Let me ask you a question. You see your kids every day. They're in a non-diverse school. I know your school's a college prep. It's excellent. The kids give a damn, so do the parents. But do you see a challenge in the fact that the kids are surrounded only by black kids and a few Latino kids for the most part? Do you see something in the kids that you know would be better if these schools were more diverse?
Yes. I wouldn't say that I see it every day. But knowing what they have to do for a life of choice, go to college and things like that, I know the things that they're going to struggle with. I know that they would benefit from being in a school with more diversity. And I know that the white kids in the suburbs would benefit from being in a school with them as well. I think that when you really look at it, and like I tell people all the time, the best that we ever did, like in the mid 90s, I think 36% of black kids went to intensely segregated schools. And that was the best mark that we've ever hit, right? Because after that,
say it again.
It started to creep
up. Say that again.
36%. So 36% of black kids went to intensely segregated schools in like the early 90s. And that was actually the best that we ever did. That's a stat from the Economic Policy Institute, I believe. And now we're back up to like 38%, 39%. So it's not something that – it's something we've been living without for a while. You know, like most kids are going to moderately segregated schools and always have. But what you need is a situation where people are exposed to differing ideas and differing opinions and different races of people, because that's the world they're going to have to work in. I don't
know
people who, especially black people, right? Because white people, they're only around white people, only go to college around white people. And that might even reflect the workforce that they work on. With black kids, it will not, right? So you're going to need to be able to interact with different groups of people. And we're not just talking about interacting. We're talking about funding here as well. Stories all the time from, like, my relatives that live back in Louisville about when they started busing. And it became, like, this big joke about how fast everything improved in their schools when, you know, white kids were coming. Because Louisville was one of the few places where they bused both ways, not one way, to appease people who didn't want, you know, desegregation, you know. So
I didn't know that.
All the schools got better. And it was almost overnight. So we're talking about funding, but we're also talking about experiencing, you know, different people, different cultures and things like that. Yeah, diversity is nice, and it's nice if people have a world globalization view. However, really what we need is for the schools to be equal. And right now, separate schools are inherently unequal. That's what the original court case said, right?
Yeah, so I was just going to say, welcome to 1953. Welcome to 1953. Yeah. Wow.
So if you're going to have that, then what you're going to need to do is give those schools and places where diversity doesn't exist, like we just talked about, those schools are going to need extra help. And
where
we're not getting that either.
Andrew, I'm telling you, you're onto something here. We got to do something about this, because I know my experience was better because I went to I went to Philadelphia Public Schools. And through junior high and high school, they were incredibly diverse. We all learned to get along. We all learned to benefit from each other. Okay? And, you know, it's something we just got to do. I wish you good luck, my friend. This is absolutely excellent. Your blog's indie.education. You're the man, Andrew. Thank you. Have a good Christmas. Santa Claus coming?
Thank you. Yeah, he'll come.
Good man. Okay. Hey, Andrew, thank you. It's a great topic. It really is
Thanks
a great topic.
Me.
Oh, my pleasure. Come back anytime. Stay in touch.
Right.
Okay?
Thank you.
Thanks, Andrew.
All right.
Bye-bye. Okay, that's Andrew Pillow. Okay? And that's just like the thing you sleep on. Andrew tweets at Andrew Pillow, and his blog is indie.education, and you can extrapolate that out to the rest of the world. This is a serious thing, and I've seen the decline of Philly public schools, which is my experience. Although I live in Maine now, I grew up in Philly, so I always love checking things out over there, regardless of the fact they have a great superintendent. Okay? But something's happened, and we got to make sure. I did a show earlier today with Tom Herr from ASCD, an ASCD author, and he talked about embracing diversity as one of the skills that all kids need to succeed. All right? And this is exactly what we're talking about. It's hard to embrace diversity when there's none around you. So, Andrew, you're onto something here. Keep up the good work. Fifth grade social studies teacher and Teach Plus, that's teachplus.org, a teaching policy fellowship alum. So thank you. This was great. Nanya, thank you. We're over at Teach Plus. We're going to archive the show at education-talkradio.org, and we're going to tweet it out over at EduTalk Radio. My name's Larry Jacobs. This is Pre-K-12 Education Talk Radio. Thank you for listening.